All right. How is everyone doing? I hope that you're doing well. Welcome to episode 18 of the Citizen Curious podcast. I am your host, Ryan Lee. We are broadcasting live and direct, as always, from the ultra-secretive, highly confidential location in Lower Manhattan, known as the Carmine Street Studios, aka my apartment. It's Wednesday, March 24th, 2021, and it is springtime in New York City, and it feels great. A much-needed thawing out of everything that we've been through over the last year. I am so excited to announce that today's guest is none other than Blake Mills. Blake is an insanely gifted songwriter, producer, guitarist, and composer based out of Los Angeles. Eric Clapton has called him one of the most inventive guitarists alive. Here's a list of some of Blake's accomplishments, and he's so kind and humble, I'm sure he'd probably be embarrassed to hear me rattle these off. He got his start in the band Simon Dawes. He went on to do session work for producers like Tony Berg and Rick Rubin. He's collaborated with Julian Casablancas, Lucinda Williams, Connor Oberst, Fiona Apple, Kid Rock, Weezer, Norah Jones, Dixie Chicks, Lana Del Rey, to name a few. He's also played with absolute heavies like Jim Keltner, Ben Montench, John Bryan. He's also put out 4 solo albums in his own right. The last one, Mutable Set, came out last May in 2020. He's also produced albums for the Alabama Shakes, for which he was nominated for the Grammy for Record Producer of the Year, Laura Marling, John Legend, Perfume Genius. He got called in to lend his ears to the last Jay-Z album, 444. He played on Bob Dylan's last album, Rough and Rowdy Ways. His most recent album, which came out a couple weeks ago, is a collaborative effort with the legendary bassist Pino Palladino. That album is called Notes with Attachments. Pino is the bassist for D'Angelo and John Mayer. It's an instrumental album inspired by jazz, funk, Afro-Cuban rhythms. It's unlike anything I've ever heard. It's a thoroughly enjoyable listen. I highly recommend checking it out. We talk about the making of that record in the really fun way that he wants to go out on tour for it when he can. So many great stories. Most of all, he's just a super nice, humble, and thoughtful guy. I really enjoyed our chat. You know, doing these interviews / conversations, whatever you want to call them, it's still funny business for me. I've strummed the guitar since I was 16. I think I've got pretty good taste when it comes to music. It's definitely one of my passions. But I'm no means a craftsman like Blake. And all I really have to offer is my ability to convey enthusiasm. I can't talk to him about the depths of production techniques, anything like that. But all we got is 2 dudes, relatively the same age, sitting on Zoom in our homes, having a chat. And it's an exercise in learning that every day I'm trying to get better at listening. I can't thank Blake enough for his time, his thoughtfulness, and his stories. So here's my conversation with Blake Mills. For me, music really kicked off in 6th grade. That's when things really went into overdrive, full Technicolor. Curious to know, when did things really kick off for you?
As a listener, I would say probably about the same age. I was in 5th grade. I was 10 years old, and I was watching a lot of MTV and VH1 instead of doing my homework or going outside and skating or something like that. So that must have like gotten real deep into the developing brain. And that's when I started playing guitar. And I think I started playing guitar just as a way to connect to what I was seeing on TV. You know, I was more of a passive listener, more of a bystander to the music that my mom or my dad would be listening to, rather than being an active participant in it and, you know, choosing what I wanted to hear Because even when you're just watching MTV, or it's like listening to the radio, you're sort of at the behest of whatever the programming is. And at that time, it was Nirvana and Soundgarden,
yeah,
Metallica, Alice in Chains.
What about Pearl Jam?
Pearl Jam might have been on there.
Yeah.
But then like also like Jewel, you know, and Alanis Morissette and Fiona and like all kinds of stuff, and that was just, it was all going in. By the time I can remember being like a little more picky about what I was listening to, it was geared towards learning the instrument. So it was like guitar players. I was lucky enough to be exposed to while I was being exposed to like the shredders, the Satriani, Steve Vai,
right,
and that whole like archetype of electric guitar player. I was also being turned on to guys like Michael Hedges and Lawrence Juber and these wizards, like technicians in their own right, but champions of the acoustic guitar. And they were like two heads on a dragon, you know. And as I got older, I developed these sort of two personalities, like these kind of like the rock fix, you know, that would be like, as I got into middle school, it was like Third Eye Blind and Our Lady Peace.
Sure.
Phantom Planet and like, you know, and then and Wilco and Ben Folds and then at the same time this more like world music influenced acoustic guitar side of me drove me towards a musician named Bob Brosman. And okay. Bob Brosman was a world music sort of aficionado who made records around the world in different countries with musicians that more or less would reflect the indigenous music of that region. One of the records that he made was with a kora player by the name of Jelly Musa Jawara.
What's a kora?
Kora it's an African harp. It's a gourd with a skin stretched over it, a drum essentially, but then it's got a big pole that then sticks into it and comes out, and then the pole essentially is like a mast on a ship, and then there's a bunch of strings coming down two sides. There's like 30 strings that come down both sides, and you play with both hands, and it just it sounds like a harp, but the way that it's played and tuned and the music that it's most traditionally involved in is it does not sound like Western music. So I became transfixed by the sound of this instrument on this record, and that was like around the time, maybe I was like 14 or 15 years old. That was around the time when I realized like music was doing something for me that was therapeutic and medicinal. And then it got serious from there.
When you're at an early age, you're not in a position to go out and actively like seek music. It's in the periphery, and you pick up on things, whether it's the radio or you walk into a Tower Records at the time, this is pre-internet era, or some of these bands are popular. And so you just naturally gravitate towards what's popular. And I was also just thinking about how discovery is so different now, and how I think that when we were growing up, like musical tastes, you were much more secular with them. It sounds like you were able to cross genres and go a little bit further, which might have, like in my development as a listener, it's been a lifelong development. Like I was pretty much solely listening to contemporary artists during my high school years. But can you go a little bit deeper just on how you made those leaps into those other genres, and you know, how that might have impacted your guitar playing?
Well, what was interesting about it is for a long time it was like two how do you call it? Like it was like double life. Like they didn't really interact, the two the two worlds. Like I had a band by the time I was in middle school. I had met this kid that knew how to play piano and guitar and sang and aspired to write songs. And we started a band together, and it satiated like all this kind of like teenage angst and all this music that I had been listening to for, you know, whatever, 5 or 6 or 7 years leading up to that point. But it didn't have anything to do with the more eclectic, like jazz or R&B and soul world music. It didn't have anything, that band didn't deal with that. And and there was even a time when, like, I think when I first started playing like quote unquote rock and roll shows, where there were people who would come and see me play with blues bands or like Southern rock bands that were more guitar based, classic rock music. And they would like turn to my dad and be like, what happened? What happened to this guy? And then my dad would tell me, be like, oh, by the way, you know, so-and-so was really disappointed. You know, not sure if you're making all the right decisions here. But
yeah, did you ever hear what your dad would say back to them? Just like, I don't know, man, he's doing his thing.
I don't know if my dad really, you know, knew. I think he was just sort of like, well, he preferred the stuff that I did that was more closely related to the music he grew up with and listened to, you know. And from an early age, I was starting to play with some people that were like of the pedigree of the Allman Brothers band and like a lot like their children, you know. And so there was this like maybe it seemed like there were these paths that I was, you know, headed for. It wasn't until I think I was no longer in that band was called Simon Dawes, and that was the precursor to the band Dawes. And it wasn't until I had left that band and started making solo records or thinking about making a solo record that I started to tear down that wall that was separating those sort of two worlds of being of listening.
Yeah. That's interesting. So I want to circle back to going into your tracing your roots through Simon Dawes, but in terms of like your development and then those high school years, and I'm curious to hear your take. One thing for me as a listener that I also found really compelling during those early years was reading about the making of the albums and reading the liner notes. And how that's a very, you just don't do that anymore. And that was a great way for me to also discover who was playing on the records. And it sparked this imagination in me of what is this place, Electric Lady, that someone like even, I'm reading about D'Angelo and Voodoo, and I even hear the name Pino Palladino, which is a great name. Like you're automatically hooked right away, but you start hearing about like, you know, all night recording sessions, and it seems so exotic and foreign and also like rich, because you're like, these guys are just sitting up all night playing music. And that's how I learned about, it was because of Fiona's record where I first saw the name John Bryan. I remember first seeing the name Jim Keltner. So I'm curious to know from you, what kind of an impact did you enjoy learning about? Did you read about the making of these albums? And I mean, even just seeing these pictures for me, the black and white pictures of the guys in the studio with the headphones on, it was intoxicating. I'm curious to know, like, and as a producer, you know, curious to know if you thought that impacted you.
Absolutely. I think the way that liner notes and studio photography and just album artwork in general, the way that all that's curated is it preserves a sense of mystery as it informs you of what's going on, you know? And speaking from experience, I know how much artists typically consider that, even if it comes across as being nonchalant or unconsidered, or is like, you know, or we're too cool to care. I think to a certain degree, most artists, most recording artists, I should say, care a lot about that, because it's another parameter that sort of goes beyond the control of what you can deal with in a song, like what you can control in a song, in a recording of the song, whatever. Like, you work all, you spend all this time making the record exactly what you want it to be, and then you realize, like, oh shit, now we got to consider the album artwork, you know, because that's going to be part of the listening experience. I think liner notes evolved over the sort of, like, since the beginning of recorded music. They went through phases of being not that informative at all to, you know, on like a classical record, for example, to being all about the technology with which the record was made, because all of a sudden you have this thing called stereophonic sound, to being about, like, in the late 70s and 80s, in certain kinds of music, you know, describing the equipment being, the instruments being used ad infinitum, like, you know, this brand new synthesizer called a Jupiter, you know, and it's like, you know, picture of somebody surrounded by knobs, proper knobs. And so now, like, when you say, you know, that's no longer the case, like, there really isn't that experience of listening to a record with liner notes. I would agree with you. I think that's correct. But what I think happens in its place is that the sort of curated image that an artist presents themselves, presents of themselves through social media,
sure,
take place. So, like, you're presumably listening on your phone, or you're listening in an environment where you have your phone nearby you. And if you are engaged in what you're hearing, you start searching, you know, and like looking at the Instagram feed or Google image search, the artist, or looking at the Wikipedia. So there still is a curated version of what that artist wants you to see, but it's no longer part and parcel to the album. It's more of like, what's this person's deal, you know, or what's this band's deal? What are they all about? And then you have to fill in the blank as a listener.
And how do you approach that?
The instinct to try to control the experience of the listener on the other side is one that I have to constantly let go of. And you don't want to do it to be controlling or manipulative. You want to do it so as to allow somebody to have like the most enriched experience that they possibly can. You know, I want to be generous in how I'm trying to curate that thing. But at the end of the day, I don't have any control over, you know, if I present all this dynamic range in a track, if they're listening to it on the freeway, you know, and there's all that, who knows what kind of car they're driving? Like, how loud is it? There's just so many variables that at the end of the day, even if you do it right, even if you could snap your fingers and have liner notes come back and do away with streaming, whatever, there's still so many aspects of that listening experience that you can't control, that it's sort of like, what, you know, what's the point?
In terms of the community and the encouragement that you might have gotten at an early age, maybe from some mentors or, you know, people that you jammed with, what were some of those initial impactful nudges that gave you that confidence to say, I'm getting somewhere, like, I'm, you know, there's a little bit of validation here, I'm getting some approval, to maybe make you think that this can be something that's viable, that I can turn into a career?
There's so many, and they still happen all the time. I think early on, Taylor Goldsmith's dad, Lenny Goldsmith, is a pretty seasoned musician, and was a touring musician for a long time, and met some some incredible players with whom he continued to occasionally perform with. And sometimes he would invite Taylor and I to sit in with them. And we really looked up to these guys. They were like, to give you an example, the bass player, Gerald Johnson, who's Steve Miller's bass player, and played with Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I think maybe also James Taylor, if I'm not mistaken. Jeffrey Young, the keyboard player, played with Steely Dan, also maybe has played with James Taylor. The drummer, Willie Ornelas, who played with James Brown when he was 16. Another drummer by the name of Frosty, Barry Frost, who was a contemporary of John Bonham. Like, I think there's stories amongst drummers and drum magazines of, like, you know, who actually influenced who, but he was sick. And all these guys were just like, these were our guys. We looked up to them, and to get to play with them,
yeah,
you know, at some New Year's Eve party or something like that, to,
yeah,
you know, at some private party at a house, or nobody was listening. It wasn't, yeah, like, that didn't matter. It was just the fact that we got to hang with these guys as players briefly gave us both a lot of validation where we were at and what we were doing, and as we were sort of like learning our crafts, so to speak.
Right.
Later on, once I started working, well, we met in that band, we met Tony Bird, a producer, who's lived and worked in Los Angeles for 40 years. He had a home studio in his backyard, and he would make records in his backyard. We were introduced to him when it came time for us to make our first proper album. And when I ended up leaving the band, and even shortly beforehand, he started to employ me as a session guitar player on records. Mm-hmm. That was the beginning of my career as a session player. You know, that really opened up my world, not just in terms of creating more opportunities for me to walk into a room and all of a sudden here are some of the heaviest musicians I've you know, ever gotten a chance to play with and who I've listened to since I was a teenager religiously, but also the fact that when you're in that role, you don't really, there's no genre that you're typically finding yourself playing in.
Yeah.
It gets really diverse in a cool way. It keeps you on your toes, and you don't get to ask a lot of questions and prepare ahead of time. Like, you know, well, what kind of music is in? What guitar should I bring? And, you know, there's no charts or anything. You're forced to converse with the moment and respond to the moment. And maybe most importantly, like, learn how to be agreeable towards another artist. And that was a huge shift from being in a band where you're a co-writer and you're sort of, you've got to put a lot of effort into just get your own artistic voice heard over the other four or five guys in the band. So it was a real role reversal, and I did a lot of growing as just a human, I think, in that process. And Tony was a mentor and still is throughout that, and that introduced me to other producers, you know, who I started doing sessions for.
Sure.
And have sort of their own thing. And every time you do one of those sessions, if it goes well, you have that experience, that sort of like, you know, wow, I brought something to this for somebody else, you know. That's bigger, I think, than doing something that's self-gratifying creatively for me.
Right. And when did you know, so after you left Simon Dawes, was there any
vacillation around music not being the thing that you were going to do? You know, were you steadfast? Like, this is it. And I'll find my way. I'll figure it out. But this is, we're locked in.
I was hopeless for anything else by the time I was in middle school. You know, I'd given up on I'm under-disciplined. Like, I'm not undisciplined, but I don't have the ability to just apply whatever disciplinary capabilities I have to just anything. Like, there has to be, I have to be drawn to it in some way. And like, that was my identity. I was really just, I knew I wasn't going to go to college. I knew I wasn't going to be able to like get straight A's. You know, I didn't really have another path. So when I left the band, it was not a sudden decision. It was sort of like, you know, the tensions at that age were like mounting. And, you know, when I left, I was 20, 21 or something like that. And like I said, I hadn't gone through that experience of working at the pleasure of somebody else's thing. It was just like, you know, you're kind of like, you go through years where everybody's just telling you like, your band is so good. And like, oh my gosh, like we got to make sure you don't make a misstep, you know, like, because the world is your oyster. And that really like rotted our little minds, you know, and like, and made us think like, oh man, what we're doing is really, really important. And part of that thinking, I think, is what made it kind of toxic at a certain point, where you're no longer in this thing that's just fun with your friends and an extension of the music that you listen to and love. You're in this thing that feels like the stakes are high and it's a business and there are other people involved that depend on you and put work in. And I just didn't know how to handle those pressures. I knew I still loved participating in music and playing guitar, and nothing about that had changed. It's just that I didn't feel like the band was the most appropriate outlet for expression, and it also felt a little like the friendships I had with the other guys in the band, if they were going to survive, would need to be severed from being business partners with them. And
so I'm trying to keep it as linear and chronological as possible, but to bring it back to some of those legendary players that I mentioned earlier, Jim Keltner, Sebastian Steinberg, Pino Palladino. As a younger guy, if you're in your early 20s and you're getting your footing doing session work, how is that experience for you to be in the room with some of these goats, you know, like the legends, and any stories of maybe coming in, you know, too hot, too flashy, just like youthful vigor and, you know, want to let them know, like, I'm here, I'm ready to roll, you know?
Yeah. Well, when we're not playing music, like just the sort of initial hang or like post, like lunchtime hang, you know, post actually getting to play. And like, if there's an opportunity to have music happen before the hang, it's so much better.
Ah, okay.
But I don't know. I kind of think like it's a testament to these musicians, these legends, that who they are as people allows somebody like me with my relative inexperience, be able to hang, to just kind of be at ease. I don't know that all musicians naturally have that, like exude that, but these are people who are my closest friends. You know, like most of my friends are like work related friends, and it's these musicians who I feel like there is sort of there's a lot that's unsaid, and this is like a tacit kind of relationship between people, like, that comes out when you play. You kind of learn a lot about somebody's personality and their character by what they choose to play and what they don't play.
Yeah.
In terms of that sort of like having something to prove and that youthful fire, I don't know if I ever felt like I had that compared to, like, I always had an idea of what that sounded like and I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
But if I go and like hear something that I played on an earlier record, I can totally hear it now and be like, I wouldn't do that now, you know?
Right.
So it's like, it's a shift, it's a sliding scale. It's sort of shifting. Yeah. But it was, you know, I never felt like I had to prove something other than like, what can I find that's just, if it gets noticed, it gets noticed for like the reason that it's serving something, kind of, it's not directing attention towards like the guitar playing or me.
Right.
I really enjoy like sitting in with bands and just kind of hanging back by between the drums and the bass and or playing percussion. Like I really enjoy locking in with something that somebody else is doing.
Yeah.
Much more so than I enjoy like singing a song or playing solo. So I know that about myself. And if I'm thinking about sessions and like my past and those opportunities where you get to walk into a playing environment with these heavies, it's not quite as gnarly as like, I'm trying to think of like who I've been starstruck by. I don't know, like great chefs or something, you know, like somebody you're just like, you're not, they're so good at what they do that you know that you're exuding your ignorance and you don't even know how.
Right. Right.
You know, but yeah, in music, it's so great. You get to just immediately meet these people without ever even saying a word to them. And you know, all these, you know them, intimately from their playing. One story, the first time I played with Jim Keltner, I mean, I've told this story before, maybe you've heard it, but the first time I played with Jim was on a session for Jacob Dylan. It never came out. The version of the song we did never came out, but it was the first time I got to play with Jim, and I really obsessed over what he does. And for the maybe the non-musician listeners to this, the way that Jim Keltner plays drums is extremely behind the beat at times, or certain parts of his drumming will be behind the beat.
And even for maybe like some of the non, you know, musical savvy listeners, what does it mean to play behind the beat? Because we'll talk about that later with Pino.
Essentially all it means is it's like where your brain might expect something that's played really precisely to be. A musician is situating it a little bit slower than that, but they're never falling off the rails. And it's a balancing act. Some musicians do it actively and on purpose, and other musicians, that's just naturally how they play and how they hear time.
Yeah.
I think it's maybe, admittedly, it's a misnomer to say Jim is just like a behind the beat player. It's not, that's overly simplistic, but his control over time and the window within which he can place a beat or a hit or a sound that he makes is much wider than most musicians have access to or allow themselves to play with. So he has this sort of like imprint, this sort of like, we're talking about this musician's sound and their sort of like natural time.
Yeah.
And it's well documented because he's also arguably one of the most prolific drummers in recording history. So
I know that feel, I know that sound. And when we finally get a chance to play together, I just can't wait to participate in that.
Right.
You know, like right. kind of wear those clothes. And
yeah.
And we start playing together and we like do a take. And it's like not sync, it's not locking up. You know, it's not really like, I feel like, oh boy, I really thought I knew this guy's thing. And it turns out I just don't. Like, it's even crazier or loopier than I thought. You know, I can't quite catch this guy. And it's like,
yeah,
hold a fish or something. And after, I don't know, a few takes, I think it dawned on me that what he does really depends on where other things are placed in, you know, where other musicians are playing. And if somebody is as behind as he is, he's no longer behind. It's sort of like, it's back to a sliding scale concept.
Right, right. It's all relative.
Yeah, so like, I stopped doing that. I stopped listening to him and like having my sort of like, where would Jim Keltner put it, you know, hat on. And the thing clicked and it worked. Right. And like looking back on it now, it's like, duh. But right. It's a really beautiful lesson to learn.
It's not too dissimilar to prepping for this podcast. I can have all the questions I want, but depending on what our connection is or how the conversation goes, at some point, it's like I'm looking at my notes, but I'm listening to you and I got to respond to what you're saying, right? And yeah. So you got to keep it natural and stay focused. And if you're there to serve someone else, that's the main objective. So you got to lock in and just be present.
Absolutely. I mean, the only thing I'm good at, really, really good at doing, I think musically, is being a conversationalist, responding to that moment.
Yeah. Well, I think that many would agree with you. So one of my earlier guests was Jay Sweet of Newport Folk. And there's a lot to cover with your solo career, but you know, you've got 4 solo albums. You've got this well-established career as a producer as well. And so Jay, I was able to get a quote from him. And he has a question for you. So Mr. Jay Sweet says, Jay has called you not only the most innovative guitar player of your generation, but an alchemist in the studio. As he says, you vibe with the music on a molecular level, which is why you've also had success as a producer. What's the difference between playing, performing, writing your own songs, and also try to pull the best out of others? What kind of mind shift do you undertake when undergoing those different things?
Yeah. Well, just taking a second to, those are all really nice things he said about me. It's really sweet, Jay Sweet.
And they just announced that they're going to try to do Newport, or they're doing Newport this summer, which is great.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah, that would be much needed for a lot of people. If they totally could do that, that'd be incredible. I won't say that there's no difference between all those different hats, but there's much less than I think it sounds like. In other words, the role of being a supporting musician on a stage or in the studio, being a co-writer, being a producer, a lot of that stuff is kind of the same approach mm-hmm. that we were just talking about. Like it's the way that you would approach a conversation, you know, like how do you rehearse for a conversation? You know, you have to rely on the things that you have a grasp on.
Yep.
You have to be honest about things that you don't have to, I guess, but like, it helps to be honest about the things that you don't know. And you have to listen. Like, you have to be not just willing to listen, but know how to listen. Sometimes it's easy to forget, even if you know how. But performing and playing shows as a solo artist, or like with a band, it does not feel as closely related to those other things as I would like. You know, I won't say that inherently it's not the same thing. I think there may be a way that other performers approach it where they found a way to kind of link it to that other process.
As it relates to, you know, Mutable Set and then, you know, Notes with Attachments, but I'm curious to know specifically with Mutable Set, that having shows stripped away from you, how that's altered your relationship with the record under like a normal scenario, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it altered my relationship. Like it altered my feelings towards touring just because it was off the table. It was like, well, if I take a step back, I was also looking forward to playing those shows because the plan was to do them as a trio with Sam Gundell and Aaron Embry, two of the musicians that I worked with on the record. And I was really excited to play those shows.
Yeah.
Mostly because I knew that we could build a show that comprised all of our writing. It didn't need to be like 45 minutes or an hour and a half or whatever of just my songs. Like both those guys are fantastic writers.
Yeah.
And incredible players. So it was just going to be this experience that I didn't have to think so much about, like crafting a show and like, how are we going to keep people's attention? It was just, I was like, finally, you know, one of these quote unquote solo tours where it wasn't all about me. And so I felt much better equipped for a tour on that round. And then the fact that touring, playing shows live was no longer an option, I think it also gave me a little bit of a perspective on why that's such a profound thing for people. It's like, it's been an extension of like my work for so long that I haven't really been able to participate in like the sacred aspect of it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if I still go to live shows, I'll have that like thing like, oh, I hate live sound, you know, or like, oh, I hate parking. Yeah. But I know now, I know how unique of an experience that is to be in a room with other people and listen to live music happening. I understand now how that does not represent most people's daily life.
Yep.
After being, we're all locked up for the most part, and not working and not able to gather. There's an aspect of it that I get now and I respect and I love, and I can't wait to be involved in again. So
I actually saw one of the shows you did with Pino. I think it was 3 years ago. I forget the name of the bar. I was down in LA at the time. Mm-hmm. And you set up like a mini residency during the winter time.
Yeah. Yeah, it was at a place called the Bar No Name.
Bar No Name, that's right, yeah. And those shows, well, I saw two of them actually, they were great. How did you link up with Pino? And then what was the experience of those live shows reflecting back?
Yeah, well, after being aware of Pino's playing, the first chance I got to work with him was when I got asked to produce a John Legend record. And part of the design for that album was knowing that it was going to be pop leaning, wanting to have a live rhythm section on everything. And the first rhythm section that came to mind was Chris Dave and Pino Palladino.
Yeah.
So that was when we actually met and first got a chance to work together on that record. And those sessions were, I think, maybe a little unusual for him in the way that we, in how much time and consideration we put into what he was doing on each track. For my limited scope of pop music and what pop records sound like, I often find the most interesting moves tend to be bass and sometimes rhythmic moves. Mm-hmm. And so that was how I wanted to approach a lot of that music, was just think of a perspective from the bass and drums first. And we got into some fun and into some trouble on that record in a good way. And around that time, I remember asking him if he had ever, like if he's a writer and if he had ever considered making a solo record. And he brought me to a session in New York and said, I'm getting together with some guys tonight and we're gonna open up this track of mine. Do you wanna come down? And if you hear anything on it, you know, play something. I said, yeah, absolutely. So we did that. I played some stuff on this track. And a few months later, out of curiosity, I just said, you know, did you listen back to me? That is any of it good? Have you opened it up yet? He said, actually, I haven't heard it since. And he was living in LA at the time. And I was home. And I said, do you think we could get that session and like, just play with it, like open it up and try some things with it? And we did. We did that at my house and started to play with the structure more than anything, like just try to create a sort of a narrative arrangement, mm-hmm. if you will, out of something that was a little more repetitive and like loop based almost. That was the first song of his own stuff that we worked on together. And that was ultimately what became Écouté on our record. And then the second song,
like, Jammin'. That's a great track. It's got a lot of movement. Yeah.
So much cool stuff going on.
Yeah.
It's like a toy store.
Yeah.
The next thing he showed me was just the chord progression for what ultimately became Just Wrong. So here are these two really different pieces of music. And my interest was just like, so peaked, you know, beyond a doubt. I was like, okay, there's no question that this guy is a really interesting compositional writer. And I think we're on the same page in terms of like the idea of a Pino Palladino solo record, what it should avoid, you know, what sure. like what roads it would be a little too easy to go down and maybe are already really well represented on other records.
Sometimes initially it's easier to know what you don't want it to be. You don't necessarily know what you want it to be, but it's just easier to say we can't.
Oh yeah. But, I mean, I think that's like the default. I think people write songs based on what they don't want.
Yeah.
It's a lot harder to identify what it is.
And it's not as fun either. I feel like it closes you off too.
Yeah. It's like you end up sort of finding these things that you like by default. And while that's honest, the expression of those things may not be as vibrant as something that you're like, I want it to be this, you know, I want to celebrate this thing. I want to make it this kind of record.
Are there plans? I mean, I know it's probably too early to definitively say yes, we'll be touring, but is there at least an intent to? This seems like this would be a really fun project for you guys to get out and jam on.
Yeah. I mean, the original plan was to like go out and do a string of dates for Mutable Set, like a pretty short one. And then really soon thereafter, almost just staying on the road, do some like Pino and Blake dates. And we might just sort of like fold that all into one thing now. I don't know. I don't know if that makes any sense. But one thing's for sure with Pino and I, we're going to be routing this tour around restaurants. I think we're going to be going on a food tour, whether the audience realizes it or not. That's going to be a big part of
mini residency in Austin. You can do right. You can do a few dates in Portland, right? They've got a great food scene.
Yeah,
obviously New York. Like, I mean, what's on the docket?
We're trying to get over to Italy. We're trying to get to Japan. You know, like I want to go play in Korea. I want to get out of the zone a little bit. You know, living in LA, our like food scene. I mean, it's very similar to New York. Our food scene is multicultural. You know, and
it's pretty phenomenal. And particularly like right now, the last few years, it's got a good thing going on.
Yeah. So we have a lot of that, but it's not quite the same as when you get out of, I just know it's not the same when you get out of here.
The Mexico, Central, South America leg, head down to Oaxaca.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
I'm sure the manager team is probably gonna love this. They're like, this is gonna be a major money, or like we are gonna be just rolling in dough on this one, guys. Thank you for this.
Oh man, I know. No, I mean we're gonna pay everybody in mole.
There you go.
You know, like mole. I think the performance aspect of these two records, it's gonna kind of figure itself out. It might not take the shape of like a standard tour, you know, in the proper venues, because those will be so blitzed. It might end up being something a little more unusual.
Love it. All right. Well, I want to be respectful of your time, so I just got a few more questions for you, and sure. We'll end on a little bit of a lightning round. Sure. What's it like when you get a call from someone who's out of what would be the perceived wheelhouse for you? So out of the, you know, more rock, folk, maybe categories that you typically tend to delve in. And specifically, I'm curious about the call from Jay-Z or whoever you get the call from to work on 444. And one, what's that like when you get a call from someone who's out of left field, really, you know? And to me, it doesn't seem like it's out of left field, because the way I view that situation is that is a person or a team or producer, it's no ID, who has great taste in music and is they're coming up with good ideas and thinking, you know, who would be a good fit with this project that we're working on. So it doesn't seem like as far of a leap from my side, but from a genre point of view, it's a little bit of a leap. So
yeah, I approach it. I approach everything with a certain amount of like, what do I know? Like at the end of the day,
yeah,
like I may be totally inappropriate for this thing, whether I like it or not. In the situation with 444, it did feel a little more like I was walking into a room and I don't think anybody necessarily knew who I was or why I was there. Mm-hmm. I think they were just sort of told by other people that they trust, like based on what was going on with the record at that time, why don't you have this guy come down and just listen to it and see what he says? And that's what I did one night. I got a call at like 11 p.m. I was in bed. Like, hey, can you come down to the studio and listen to this stuff? And I said, sure. So I went down, I listened to the record, and I thought where the record was at was great. I was like, I was like, well, look, this is phenomenal. If there's something that you're not happy with it, I would say the only area where I think it could maybe grow or do something other than what it's doing. I don't remember what I said, but it was like, you know, you essentially sound like it sounds like you're existing on top of the music. You know, like the music is sort of happening and you're responding to it, which is, I think, how it was constructed. It was like the tracks were made first and then Jay wrote through the track. Like, what about ways in which the music can then respond to what you've written and underscore some of the lyric content? And so the idea was to approach it like an arranger, like an orchestrator, and take instrumentation from the tracks, the samples, and kind of make a painting, you know, come to life in a way around right. certain lyrics and certain drops and stuff like that. And that was the only thing that I did not listen to that and think like, oh yeah, any of this stuff's in trouble. Like what I heard is essentially, I think, what came out.
You weren't like, oh, you called the right guy. All right, now I can.
No, I was like.
No, I'm joking.
I was like, this is great. But I didn't have anything to lose. Like, I didn't consider myself as like walking into a room where I was like up for a producer role, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I was walking in because they were going to be a listener, you know?
Yeah.
Like, if one person can somehow be a better listener of music than another, they thought I might have something to offer as a listener, you know? So that's what I was there for. Worked for a few weeks. I don't know if anything that we did is on that record. I doubt it. Things were moving really fast, but that was my, that was just my goal, was like, I want to make sure that like the actor in this scene of this story, being the song and being Jay, like whatever style song it was and whatever style with which he was delivering the vocal, that like the lighting was right.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate you divulging that. My next question is Laura Marling, Semper Femina. When I first read that you were pairing up with her, that seemed like made all the sense in the world. She feels like the female's kind of counterpoint to you, very unhurried, patient, complete thought records. Would love just to hear a few thoughts on that recording experience with her, because it's the record is just amazing.
Oh, wow. I'm glad to hear you say that. I listened to it for the first time not that long ago. Well, the first time in a long time, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, because we just started conversing again about songs and recordings and stuff like that, and trying to do something together. So when I first found out that she was interested in working together, I needed to do like a deep dive to sort of fill in the blanks between the songs of hers that I knew. Like, I needed to listen to the albums that those songs were from. And
meaning so her prior work, or like what she was vibing off of when making the new songs, her prior work.
No, her prior work.
Gotcha. Okay.
Which is not typically something I do as a producer.
Yeah.
Like, I'll usually not listen to, if I'm not already familiar with an artist's repertoire.
Yeah.
I'll usually not listen if we're working together until after. But with Laura, I wanted to try to wrap my head around her musicianship. I understood her prowess and what she's capable of as a songwriter. That was clear to me. As a singer, that was clear to me. But like, I also realized as I started hearing demos of the stuff she was working on that like she's a killer guitar player. And so I was going back through the records to try to get a sense of like, where could some of this stuff go? You know, like if we wanted to push it, what would pushing mean? Like how far, where are we starting from?
Yeah.
It was also a record where I was surprised, I think, to learn that she had a band that she'd been playing with that she wanted to record with. Like, she had musicians that were going to come over from England with her. And I was not so used to doing that. Like, I wasn't that used to recording bands necessarily. I think I'd done the record with the Alabama Shakes, but I knew that band to have a sound. I understood right. like that they were a proper band.
She was kind of coming in more like solo artist, so you just weren't really anticipating that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I was probably starting to think like, all right, who am I going to get on this?
Right.
Yeah. So working with her musicians was also like outside of my comfort zone, as was working with somebody who was like, I don't know. It was not as easy as it might be if the musician I'm working with is not necessarily like the best guitar player. It's really easy to step in and fill that role and just,
yeah.
Okay, I can play anything that you don't feel like doing while you're singing, or anything that I think maybe you'll sing better if I take over that responsibility. Yeah. Laura, the way that she writes and the way that she plays, it doesn't sound better when somebody else is playing her parts. Like her singing doesn't get better. Like it needs to be the thing, you know, no matter who you are, like even if you're the best guitar player on earth. So it was like, I was learning all this stuff about her and it was informing how we were going to make the record. And it's kind of scary to be learning when you've already like started, like you're
right.
Day four, day five, and like song three or whatever, and you're still sort of figuring this thing out. But I think that is probably represented on the album in some way. Like I think that affected the sound of the album, the fact that it was not a fully formed idea. Yeah.
At any point.
I think we were both kind of like learning about what that record was going to be throughout the process. And it surprises me. Like when I listened to it a few weeks ago, the things that I remembered they didn't sound quite like as I remembered them, you know, to be. And again, it's like that thing when somebody else plays it other than you, it sort of has a life of its own, a mind of its own.
Right. Right.
And I went back and I was just like, you know, wow, this feels like a record I've never even heard before.
Wow. Very interesting.
Yeah, it was really cool. But yeah, I mean, all to say, I think the world of her and what she's capable of doing in the music that she puts out. And we're, I think, both really looking forward to figuring out some way to work on more stuff together.
Awesome. Awesome. I mean, her last record was just amazing. So yeah, good.
Beautiful.
So good. All right. Well, in your line of work, in some ways, I don't know if all roads lead to, but all roads at least pass through one gentleman in particular named Bob Dylan that you were able to play on his last record. We could devote a whole podcast just around the making of Rough and Rowdy Ways. How does that call come in? How does its kickoff? How does the call come in? Is, you know, does someone say we're going to call on a landline?
I think there may have been a few people over the years that have tried to plant a seed, but there are a lot of like, he's got to be dealing with that from every angle.
I know.
I don't know what got through to him. I know it wouldn't have happened if not for Charlie Sexton, Jeff Kramer, probably a lot of other people who I'm not even aware of, but like it happened very naturally and kind of took on a life of its own. I think we all knew that if it turned into something like an opportunity to work together, there would be no way to predict what that meant before something actually happened. Like it's just everybody in his camp who's worked with him before knows better than to like plan.
Right.
So it was in terms of experiences where you go in without an expectation of what's going to happen that day, where you know, even if, as much as you want to be prepared, there's nothing to prepare. Mm-hmm. It was the most distilled form of that, of a recording session I've ever been on.
And from what I've heard, that seems to be his sort of preferred method of recording. He wants people to be fresh.
I think so. I can't speak for records I wasn't a part of, but as a fan of his, I've always assumed that that's what's going on those sessions. But I think maybe like what I realized after working on a record with him was like, I realized that I don't know. I realized that like a lot of the things that I thought, you know, I understood about him, or maybe that I understood about those records, I realized like, oh, I could really easily be wrong. You know, I mean, as wrong as people are about Rough and Rowdy Ways in terms of like, you know, thinking things about like, I don't know, track orders or like alternate, I don't know. There's so many, there's such a mythology around him. And I wonder what that must be like, you know, being aware that there's that mythology. I wonder what it must be like when you're just trying to do a thing.
Yeah.
It's like, he doesn't make records in a world that anybody else makes records in.
Like you get to the point where like, you wonder if he seems like he almost like lives in a world, such a pure, singular artistic world that's, you're like, this is definitely not like my existence, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, and at the same time, it is the plight of every artist. Like it's,
right,
you know, when it's a human who's putting everything they can put into this thing they want to be great. And it's interesting to think about these records that feel like they're like the tenets of American songwriting. It's interesting to think that there was a time when they were being made, they didn't exist yet. They were being made and like figured out, you know, by him and by everybody else who was working on those records. Like the discovery process is something that's really ultimately, in the case of Rough and Rowdy Ways, it's led by him. Like he's the one who knows when the story's coming across, when the scene, you know, is clear, and the performance of the actor is like just right. You can all be sort of on the same page, and yet you don't necessarily know when he's going to hear the thing in it that he wants and that he likes, and that's more or less the cardinal direction.
Congrats for playing on that. I mean, I'm sure it was absolutely amazing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the greatest experiences of my life. Period.
I can only imagine. All right, so I've got a quick lightning round.
Okay.
This comes from Mark Maron. He wants to know when you're going hiking again.
Oh my God. Well, I want to try to get, he does this one trail. He does this one path, and we both live in Glendale, and there is a dearth of trails out here that I want to try to take him on a new one. So I might have to like kick it back to him and be like, you know, all right, it's on you. You know, it's on you, Mark. But I think he does like 2 days a week. So we'll try for Thursday.
What have you been listening to over the pandemic? Top three artist albums that you've been listening to over the last 12 months?
As I said, I've been listening to a lot of music, and a lot of it's been instrumental. And John Hassell, Jimmy Giuffre, and Georgia Ben. It's like Brazilian, it's Brazilian pop music from the 60s and 70s maybe, more so the stuff that I've been listening to. I've been following my friend, a friend of mine is involved with an organization called In Sheep's Clothing, and they transitioned from being a sort of hi-fi listening bar here in Los Angeles to obviously having to shutter that, and they turned towards being kind of like a record club.
Oh, cool.
And they do a lot of, they have a lot of like playlists and things that they curate, and there's a lot of stuff on there that I'll kind of like pick through and listen to.
for inspiration, but it's interesting. Like ambient music has kind of felt appropriate for this last year where you're maybe just trying to create more space than you are in.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, Mutable Set. So I live in New York City. I'm in the West Village. And when we were in full blown lockdown, Mutable Set was sort of like my go-to music when I would go on a morning walk, and I would put the good headphones on, and there was something about the qualities of the way that Never Forever just sort of like eased into the walk. Mm-hmm. And that song in particular was a positive thing to hear, because you're kind of describing like the mundane parts of like waiting just to get a cup of coffee, and you couldn't do that at the time. You couldn't do any of that. And so it was a nice way just to feel a little bit of humanity, and like all music has a balming quality, or some music has a balming quality. And so it provided that. But then as I would continue my walk through Soho, and you can imagine there's not a soul. So I'd be out walking at like 7:30 a.m. and going down Prince Street, and you know, you'd pass 2, 3, 4 people. It was surreal. It was surreal, but it was good music for that time. The ambient textures lended itself to a very interesting listening experience of walking around Soho during this absolutely bizarre time that we're in.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, the music that came out in those first few months, I think nobody making those records obviously could have predicted the world in which they were going to be received in.
Yeah.
But I noticed a profound difference in the way people were listening to music and connecting with it.
You've obviously told us that you're going on a food culinary tour with Pino. We've had a lot of time to hang out in the house, to cook. What's been your go-to meal? Are you someone who likes to cook? And if so, what do you think that you've perfected over the last 12 months?
Okay. So I've been lucky enough to eat very well, because Gabby, my partner, is a phenomenal cook.
Cool.
And we started living together at the start of the pandemic. So when she's cooking, I'm at the behest of whatever she feels like making, and
right.
I know it's always going to be great. When I'm cooking, it's like coin toss. I don't really know what I'm doing, but I obsess about stuff. Like I obsess about a record, and it's the only thing I want to listen to for however long. So I started over the last couple months getting like really into oatmeal. I'd never been into oatmeal. I never was like, other than like that weird like Quaker sugary stuff that you just pop in the microwave.
Right.
I was never into cream of wheat. I was never into like proper oatmeal. And
are you doing the thing like the Irish oats where you soak it for a little bit? Yeah. Have you gotten deep like that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I love it. Like I chop up dried fruit and like, you know, experiment with like when I put it in the pot and stuff. And I just love it. I love that it's oatmeal and there's like so much thought that can go into it. And I'm sure like the people that don't like my music, if any of them are listening to this, they're probably thinking like, oh, that makes sense. Like oatmeal guy, you know, making oatmeal records.
Right.
It ties it up nicely for my detractors. But yeah, it's been, like you said, a balm, you know, it's been a really, that's a comfort food. That's not super guilty. It's been my thing.
I dig it. The thing that I don't know if I've mastered it, but I certainly didn't have any skill in making this thing before the pandemic, was an omelet. And it was one of those things where I was like, I'm 38 years old. I should know how to make this by this stage of my life. But I've never actually made one. I've done scrambled eggs. I cook a fried egg at least once a week. And Ludo from Petit Trois, mm-hmm. he was doing these you know, Insta Lives at the start of the pandemic, and he laid out the recipe. And so that was like my weekly thing, is every Saturday I would just start a new one. And now I'd like to think I make a pretty mean French omelet. I had to have the amount of butter, because it was just obscene. Like, he is obscene. Well, obviously he's French, so he's going to pour it on, but
Every stage is like bookended with butter.
But the key is that if you're ever going to make one, do the freshly grated Parmesan. Don't go out and buy it in the plastic can, or not the plastic can, but you know, in the plastic that's pre-grated. You got to do it fresh. That's the only way to do it.
Yeah. No, I mean, Parmesan is one of the places we want to hit on this tour. We got to find the sweet club in Parmesan. I got a Japanese skillet, like a tamago skillet, a square.
Okay.
To be able to do the rolled omelet.
The special Japanese one.
Yeah.
Wow.
So like doing like tamago rolled omelets for rice bowls or like omelet sandwiches and stuff like that. That's my newest egg.
So is the cooking process of that similar to the French omelet? Cause Ludo is all about the low heat, and then you're just constantly stirring. So it takes a little while, but like super low heat to get that crepe like quality, right?
Yes. And also like you whisk the eggs to like a really, like you kind of go overboard where they're okay to be like a little clumpy in other styles of like omelets or egg making, scrambled eggs. Like, I think the more you whisk, the better it's going to be, until the point where it's like almost watery before you put it in.
Right.
And then you mix it with a little mirin and constantly stir and sort of circulate. Right. And then before it's fully cooked, you start rolling it rather than, you know, folding it like you would the omelet.
Yep.
You roll it, and then you just keep going. Like, you just keep building this thing.
Right. You know?
And it's an easy way to put down like three eggs if you're not careful.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, Ludo, correct you. You always roll the omelet. You never fold it. He would tell you, always roll it. Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah. I've been having fun, you know, getting... I'm pushing my own personal envelope a little bit in the kitchen this year. So
I dig it, man. Well, that's all I got for you.
Cool.
I hope you had fun. I really do appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for having me and for the conversation.